It's been a tradition now at the faculty division of the Federalist Society to have a luncheon debate. And this year, I think we have a really wonderful debate, really for two reasons. Many of our debates, for instance, on the Second Amendment and on Heller, many of our members come in with strong priors for one side or the other. But this debate really pits values that the Federalist Society shares on both sides. On one side, this question of whether the FDA is regulations are preempt state law. On the one side, of course, is federalism and democratic autonomy. On the other is the interest that people have in only being subject to one regulator, and also the interest in economic efficiency, and not abstractly economic efficiency, but economic efficiency in medical innovations. And I don't know about the rest of you, but that's the kind of efficiency that I've become more interested in with the passing of each year. Secondly, I think this is a wonderful also kind of debate, again, unlike something like Heller. In those kinds of issues, I think every member of the society is eager to read the latest opinion of the Supreme Court on what it says about the Second Amendment. I have to confess, and this is an admission against interest, however, that preemption decisions, on the other hand, have a kind of thick doctrinal complexity that does not lend itself to always getting one down to read the advance sheets. And so we actually have had a few decisions in this area, and so another great advantage of this debate is an opportunity for actual learning. Here are the ground rules of the debate. I think the debaters need no introduction. Professor Rick Hills from New York University and Richard Epstein from the University of Chicago. Each will speak for 12 minutes, which I will enforce, and then there'll be 5 minutes of rebuttal, and then we'll open it up directly to your questions. And Richard Epstein will speak first.
Thank you. As is fitting for a topic of this sort, the first question that I asked John is, I said, A, what's the procedures, and B, which side am I on with respect to this debate? And I think there's actually a reason why it is that I approach this subject with uncharacteristic diffidence, and it's because my own opinions about this structure will, under any account of the subject, necessarily yield to whatever it is that the Congress wants to say. That is, the true guilt in this particular area goes back to a series of decisions on which I am still unreconciled, having to do with the enormous and expansive scope of the Commerce Clause, which essentially creates a constitutional order in which every form of productive activity is in principle subject to concurrent regulation at both levels. And this is a conscious departure from the earlier systems on this point, where, although it was not a perfect separation for many activities, one sovereign for one problem, and so therefore you had only the single system of regulation. Now, the reason why I think this problem then becomes more acute is that when you're trying to figure out with the New Deal frame of mind as to how we think about concurrent legislation, you do not see in Justice Douglas's extremely important opinion in Rice against Santa Fe, which sets out the basic framework, the idea that there's a diminishing margin of utility with respect to additional increments of regulation on any particular form of industry. And so what he says, in effect, is that the more the merrier translates into a presumption against preemption, which can work in two particular ways. One, with respect to the way in which you interpret the explicit text of a statute, and secondly, on the way in which you start to deal with the questions of how it is you deal with matters of implications. What kinds of presumptions do you create on those things, and why? And there is no question that, at least in the early stages of the particular area of law, what we did is we came up with a system of dual regulation as being presumptively desirable. Then what happens is you get a list of three exceptions, field preemption, conflict preemption, and frustration preemption, which could be read broad enough to gut the basic presumption, except for the fact that it seemed pretty clear that Justice Douglas did not want us to do it this way, because his original assignment was that there's a clear and manifest case for the basic rule, and then what you have to do is to fight to get yourself in to these kinds of narrow exceptions. Now, in some sense, when you then apply this to the question of tort liability, in 1946, this is a complete non-starter because there's no tort liability of any sort kind of description that you would have to preempt with respect to the sort of warning cases in question. If you were to look at the standard product liability case of this time, a duty to warn case was something like Pease against the Sinclair Company, in which what you did is you said that something was in fact oil. When it was water, some poor schmuck put some sodium into this oil, which is water, and the things exploded, and all of a sudden you have to decide whether or not you'd like to preempt this claim on some federal ground, and I dare say you will find nobody who's in favor of it. If you go to the kinds of duty to warn cases that you had with respect to the tort law in 1965 before you get all the other stuff, the typical design defect case was the situation where you put a key in the ignition, turn the switch, and the car explodes because somebody left too much gas inside the tent. And if you were to ask yourself whether or not with that kind of a cause of action you'd like to have federal preemption going on because of some general regulation of the automobile industry, I don't think that there was anybody who would really want to do that as well. So at least if you want to take this as a contraposition of the regulatory system and the tort system as they existed in the formative days of preemption, there isn't much of a tension that you have to resolve, and it's pretty easy to see why a tort law which is this narrow and this focused will in fact do fine. But at the time we start moving forward after the second FDA amendments in 62 and so forth and the expansion of product liability and duty to warn cases in the 60s and 70s, all of a sudden the question about the collision between the two systems becomes much more manifest because basically the definition of a product defect simply changes from one which says, to take tobacco as an example, the defect is a contamination in tobacco, and it becomes a definition which says that tobacco itself is the defect. And now all of a sudden in the warning cases, essentially the problems that you have are not with genuine outliers where nobody has any dispute about the substantive merits. They are on cases which are absolutely mainstream. And now you have to decide essentially between one of two principles. And the first principle is to say, look, what we really are doing with preemption is not worrying about merits. That's something for the Congress to do. Our job is to basically preserve, come hell or high water, the structure that Justice Douglas created in 1946. And so we believe in the dual stream of regulation. It turns out, therefore, that when you think of state regulation as a form of regulation, it doesn't trouble you very much. Unless you find clear and explicit grounds for preemption, you're not going to do it. Or you can say, look, what happens is we're less interested in the constitutional niceties of 1946 and 1937, and what we're much more interested in is the way in which you have to structure modern care, taking into account the vagaries of both federal and state law, where there is more regulation at the federal level and more aggressive tort situation. And at this particular point, the case against preemption becomes, I think, much more attractive because it turns out that there's some genuine elements of insanity in the outcomes of these particular cases which should trouble just about everybody. One of the things that we do at the federal level is we announce that we want to make sure that we only let those drugs onto the marketplace which meet very rigorous standards of safety and health care, and that we only want to put on these things warnings which basically alert people to all the downside. And if I were trying to critique the situation with respect to the FDA, I would say for the most part it's become far too restrictive and far too cautious in the way in which it goes, and that what happens is there are too many new molecular entities that are kept off the market relative to those which are getting on, and the genuine crisis is the delay in the innovation of life-saving therapies. If you look, for example, at the anti-preemption articles that are written by people like David Kessler and David Fladek, this is their attitude. The FDA always makes mistakes. They're always in one direction. The direction is they always let things go on the market which ought to be kept off, so the tort system becomes a necessary practical supplement to make sure these things don't go awry. And, you know, David was my tort student, and the first one, Kessler, he did not internalize the lessons of the class as far as I could see. And the serious problem that in fact remains is that the FDA remedy will only work, or the tort remedy, where the FDA is too lax. In fact, if the FDA is too stringent, the imposition of an unliquidated tort damage on top of a regulatory system of this sort becomes absolutely catastrophic, and there is absolutely nothing that you can do to order stop this. So how does one want to think about this? Well, the statute, unfortunately, is of a little bit of help, but not a lot of help. And that's why I don't know which side of the debate I'm on. When you start dealing with devices, I think you can say that the decisions with respect to presumptions that was given, I guess it's in the Rigel case, whatever they call it, that was probably a fairly honest reading of the statute, and that you would not want somebody who had a product that was put on the market at rated at 10 as being said impliedly, oh, by the way, if you want to try it at 12, be my guest, because we really don't have anything to say about it. And you'll surely find some jury somewhere which is going to go along and say that the misuse of a product should generate liabilities. I regard that as essentially inconsistent with the preemptive scheme, and so I assume that Rick would probably agree with me that that's not a case in which you really want to have state tort actions, and that's why he's not sure of what side of the debate he's on either, because there's no way you can be kind of black and white on this stuff. When you come out on the implied preemption side, it's a much more difficult question. I have about 2 or 3 minutes, I guess. That you, when you sort of try to work yourself through there, it's a much more difficult question to figure it out, because the first thing you note is that if there's an explicit preemption on the device side and there's none on the drug side, you can draw the argument from the exclusion that that means that nothing happens. But again, this field has become so tangled that you could draw that argument only presumptively but not absolutely. If you go back to the Geyer case having to do with the similar problems on private rights of actions with the airbag controversy, Justice Breyer, in a convoluted, difficult, obscure, and sound opinion, essentially came up with the conclusion that given the exhaustive level of oversight that you had at the regulatory level, you were not going to permit private rights of actions under tort law to sabotage the situation. So even in a statute which had an express preservation of the common law right, he was not prepared to allow it in this kind of a case. So that now we know, at least as a matter of current federal constitutional construction or statutory construction, that the express yes, implied no argument is no longer valid, that there is still the question of whether you can have field or whether you can have conflict preemption. And in the recent Wyeth and Levine case, which was another one of these groundless and absolutely mindless sort of medical malpractice actions, that is not the malpractice action may have been valid, but the action against the manufacturer of the drug was not. What you do is you have a situation in which everybody warns, warns, and warns about what the dangers are. You have a doctor who's willing to run the risk. We don't know whether he makes the right or wrong decision. But if you look at this thing institutionally, what happens is you cannot, in terms of sound institutional design, assume that if somebody is given the right information that allows a full decision to be made on an unbiased basis by a downstream party, you want to turn around and say, oh, no, no. What you have to do is to warn these people not to do the very procedure which the FDA has talked about, so that the way in which the current system seems to be evolving is that the defendant's bar on these cases, in fact, is pushing for conflict preemption, and I disagree with them to the extent that I think that field preemption, which is a slightly stronger form of preemption, is appropriate in this case. And just to make it more miserable than it was before, the last point I'd want to mention is now the ugly Chevron doctrine has intruded into this area because of the benevolent interventions of Dan Troy and other people. And the harder question becomes, if the agency takes a position, ought that to influence what the Supreme Court does? And this is my one-line sentence on Chevron, which is, I think it is a criminal offense, for any judge on a matter of pure statutory construction to defer to any administrative agency, regardless of its party, and that you only do the deference on various kinds of fact questions and collection questions. So I just don't want to see the cases decided that way, because we know that the first thing that the Obama administration will do is basically to reverse this particular ruling, and the flip-flops are intolerable. So I guess what I want to say is that my basic position is I'm very uneasy about private rights of action that blow up schemes. I think the circumstances of these relationships have changed radically over the 60 years, and so I would have a kind of rule which doesn't give you a presumption against preemption based upon federalism considerations. I would want it to rather work about the statutory integrity of the schemes in question and whether or not I think that the private rights of action enhance the overall system. If not, then you can think them as being preempted when there's a textual or a structural ground for doing so. If not, then you don't. I don't think this sounds like a man who's on a high horse charging over the cliff, but now that Rick is going to speak, it may well turn out that I shall be buried underneath his hooves. Thank you very much.
I'm going to time this one with a stopwatch. because this is one of those areas, as Richard says, where indecision rules the day. I mean, usually libertarians like Richard and myself believe that private law is superior, outperforms centralized regulation. Usually we tend to think that torts, contracts, and property does a better job than a single agency governing roughly 300 million people with a $2 billion budget supervising a $1.5 trillion economy. Indeed, usually Richard and I would agree that the notion that the FDA can reasonably assess the risk of drugs and the risk of adverse events emerging from post-market approval of drugs is ludicrous. Indeed, the FDA itself admits it is in no position whatsoever to supervise the drug, food, medical device, veterinarian device, cell phone, and I could go on, market. There's no conceivable way that they could supervise this. This is like one of those ringmasters surrounded by 100 elephants who pretends with his little whip that he can make them run in a circle. The FDA, in fact, in 2007, published a report from their own Scientific Advisory Board Subcommittee on Technology and Science saying, we are pretending to supervise an industry. We cannot conceivably do it. Example, we have a $60 billion cosmetics industry. How many FDA staffers are assigned to this industry? 14. They have a budget of $3.5 million. That's like our clinical budget at NYU. The notion that they're actually supervising cosmetics is, of course, absurd. What they actually do is prod industry every once in a while when they get around to it. And when they get around to it is usually when there's a crisis. Say in 2004, Vioxx becomes a scandal because it turns out that Vioxx and other COX-2 inhibitors seem to cause heart attacks. And the Merck and other manufacturers of these COX-2 inhibitors never knew that they caused heart attacks. And so Congress comes down heavy on the FDA and says, do something about this. And so the FDA says, oh, we never did any post-market surveillance to discover what the effects of COX-2 inhibitors were because we couldn't conceivably do it. We don't have the staff. So then they start focusing on that problem after several people may have died. Now, I think that if you're a libertarian or somebody who has Hayekian skepticism about the cognitive capacity of centralized regulators, you will tend to think that it is not a good idea to assume that when the FDA is silent or ambiguous, that they therefore have made a considered judgment about the risks of a drug. And from that single assumption, FDA silence or ambiguity does not really indicate a considered judgment about risk. I think you have to reject the idea of broad implied preemption. Let me give you an example. And with this example, I want to illustrate, because I've already used 3 minutes, four basic principles that I think should guide implied preemption, not only with the FDA, but with every federal agency. Principle number one should be the agency must specifically reject the judgment on which state tort liability is based. Principle number two is the rejection must actually be supported by evidence and not ipsy-dixit. That is to say, it must comply with Section 706 APA standards for having some factual basis. Third, a preference for contract or a preference for deregulation, and this is where I'm hoping we can get some little back and forth with Richard, that perfectly legitimate preference, a preference that Richard and I share, should not be the basis for construing federal preemption doctrine. Even if you love contract and think that, for instance, the risk of a problem with a drug should be based upon a contract between a patient and a doctor, or between a doctor and a pharmaceutical company, so that product liability should be more often than not governed by warranty, by contract, by express stipulation, even if you believe that, I say that that value can play no role whatsoever in governing preemption doctrine. Fourth, if you are concerned with runaway tort liability, and you also believe in federalism as I do, then everybody in this room should start focusing on choice of law and conflict of law principles to make sure that states internalize the nonsense that they sometimes impose with their tort system. Conflicts of law and choice of law should be the primary field of battle, not federal preemption. We should not create a federal monster to get libertarian objectives. First of all, that will backfire. Guess what? You no longer have a Republican FDA. And so to the extent that you build up Chevron deference or build up broad implied preemption, you might find yourself facing, say, the Army Corps of Engineers, issuing ambiguous regulations on, say, property rights. Do you really want to have a bunch of precedents that say whenever they sneeze, that means that state property law has been preempted? I don't think so. And so with my four principles, specific rejection of the state law judgment, rejection supported by evidence, and preference for contract or preference for libertarianism not playing a role, and finally, choice of law principles playing a big role, let me talk about the kind of implied preemption I think would be a very bad idea. And in talking about this, I actually want to use a specific case, Wyeth v. Levine, just because you all know about it, I assume, or read about it, and because it's something that Richard and I both know about. In Wyeth v. Levine, what you got is a drug, an antihistamine called Phenergen, that can be administered intravenously, or it could be administered intramuscularly, that is, say, just inject your muscle with the drug, and it basically stops nausea. That's its benefit. Nobody says it's a life-saving drug. Nobody says that if we're taken off the market, anybody would really suffer much more than vomiting. It's a nice anti-nausea, anti-allergen drug. So what are the benefits? You know, moderate. What are the costs if you screw up? Well, it turned out this drug was approved in 1955, and by the 70s it was clear that if you push injection into an artery, that injection could leak into a vein. And if it leaks into a vein, the vein collapses, gangrene ensues, and you have to amputate the limb into which it was injected. This was a well-known risk. How great a risk it was uncertain. But it is a definite risk. And so the FDA actually had a warning, and here's what the warning said. It's a pretty funny warning, because it doesn't actually apply to anti-allergens in particular. It's just a general warning that goes like this. For any irritant drug, it is usually preferable to use intravenous infusion, meaning a gravity drip, rather than what we'll call push injection. Usually preferable? Well, the reason why the FDA might want to provide an option for push injection is that in severe emergencies with life-saving drugs where you don't have a little bag ready and an IV unit, you might want to use push injection. But the problem is, for antihistamine drugs, these emergencies never arise. For this particular drug, there is never any call for push injection. You'd have to be a moron to use push injection. But the warning says it's usually preferable for any irritant drug, which can include any number of drugs. You know, for instance, adrenaline, if you're having some kind of seizure. So you might think that a pharmaceutical company like Wyeth would want to put on their box, by the way, for drugs that don't have any life-saving potential and no emergency use, don't use push injection. And indeed, at oral argument with Wyeth, one of the first questions was to both the government, I think it was Ed Needler who argued the government's amicus case, and to Seth Waxman, is there any commonsensical reason why you'd ever use push injection for this drug? And the answer, of course, was, well, they should have said no. It would never make any sense whatsoever to use push injection for an antihistamine. Instead, they said, well, for many drugs, there could be a use for push injection, and the FDA, in its considered judgment, thought that this option for push injection should be preserved. Now, here's Hills's principle number one. If the FDA didn't say it, it can't preempt. Ms. Levine loses her arm because a doctor, after using intramuscular injection, decides he's going to use vein injection. Actually, this is surprisingly common. I actually hit the blogs, the websites, for nurses, and they said, you know, we always use intra-arterial injection for this kind of drug. It's just routine. And all our handbooks said it's okay. Why? Well, they hadn't been updated, and nobody really had thought about the risks. Why? Because the risk of gangrene doesn't occur that often. It occurs maybe once in every 100,000 to 500,000 cases. The clinical trials for the drug usually only involve 2,000 subjects, so you're not going to pick up this risk with usual clinical trials. And so, you know, most of the people were actually using this method. Sure, the package says it's usually preferable to use drip, but come on, you're a doctor. You read the side of the package, says it's usually preferable to. Does that say to you, oh my God, unless there's an emergency, I shouldn't be push injecting a drug that's basically to stop nausea? I mean, Ms. Levine was a guitarist who came to the clinic because she was throwing up a lot. She had hay fever, and she was, you know, suffering from headaches and nausea. And so if you thought that there was a serious risk of amputation, you'd say, look, I'll give this drug to you by drip, but there's no hurry. We can set up the drip. It would be insane to give it by push injection. The box itself did not communicate that fact. Now, it strikes me that unless the FDA said fairly specifically, we have considered the value of push injection for antihistamine drugs, and we think that option should be preserved, that state tort liability against Wyeth for not putting a prohibition right on the box should be preserved. What will that give Wyeth an incentive to do? To prod Leviathan. The FDA never reached any judgment about push injection for one simple reason. Their Office of Regulatory Affairs, which is supposed to do post-market surveillance, I mean, we always heard about time to actually approve a drug, but actually just a big issue is to figure out what the drug does once it's approved. You want to get data on what happens. Do people's arms fall off? Do they turn green? What happens to these people? And post-market surveillance at the FDA is a joke. There's a reason why it's a joke. The skills you need for post-market surveillance are statistics. You need to be able to do data regressions to figure out whether a problem that occurs is a serious problem, which means you need serious statistical talent. And as the FDA's own science advisory board reported, there are no sufficient statisticians in the Office of Regulatory Affairs that does the post-market surveillance. And so it's no surprise that although three or four or five or a dozen people's arms had in fact fallen off through push injection, the FDA hadn't picked up on this. And so when these pharmaceutical companies go to the FDA and say, we think we should update the label, the FDA typically says, we're not sure. I think we'll just stay the course. Now, it would be nice to give those companies an incentive to go to the FDA and say, we are going to update the label without your say-so, which they have the right to do as long as they don't create a misstatement of fact. What we'd call a misbranding violation. We want to give them some incentive, in other words, to prod the FDA so they'll focus on a problem. And the best way for a problem to emerge might very well be state private law. In this case, the FDA had a warning that discussed a risk, but the FDA itself and its scientific staff never compared drip versus push injection and never thought really about whether with antihistamine drugs or non-emergency, non-life-saving drugs, there was ever any role for push injection. And so it seems to me that when a state jury in Vermont comes back with a $7 million verdict against the pharmaceutical manufacturer, that that ought to be preserved. What value does that have? It forces a pharmaceutical company to go to the FDA and forces the FDA to actually engage in notice and comment rulemaking about a real risk. That seems to me a good thing, given that we have assumed that Leviathan will not act until it gets some kind of sharp prodding like that. Second principle, with 12 minutes, and I'm done. Well, I get 1 minute? Good. I think that the FDA's judgment that a risk assessment is erroneous must survive the same standards of administrative law as ordinary 706 review. The FDA did say, we want to keep this label. And in a preemption preamble to a 2006 drug labeling rule, they said, we think that all of our drug warnings are preemptive of any extra warnings. Here's their defense. State law attempts to impose additional warnings can lead to labeling that doesn't accurately portray a product's risk. That's true. I like the use of can. It's quite possible. Thereby potentially discouraging safe and effective drugs. That was it. Now, anyone who reads that can see that some staffer at the FDA simply wrote something up saying, you know, there is this possibility that sometimes extra warnings are bad. That's nice, but we're not interested in whether in general extra warnings are bad. We're interested in whether an antihistamine drug should be given by push injection. The notion that this preemption preamble indicates that the FDA considered that fact is preposterous. And therefore, I would give no deference to those kinds of general judgments that are not based by evidence. Now, I have two other points that I've already announced, which is that libertarianism should not play a role in lawyers in this room's pushing for preemption. And the other one is that choice of law should be the main focus of our efforts to make sure that Vermont, if it does impose outrageous liability, pays for it in their insurance premiums alone. But my time's up, and so I'll be glad to discuss those points in rebuttal. Thanks a lot.
Start with the last of the points first, which is that I spent many years ago, 30 years ago, I worked with the American Insurance Association on various questions of tort reform, and the proposal was made that we try to use choice of law conflict principles in order to resolve this question. And we started with one case after another, and we could not find a single theory which would have any traction whatsoever in any particular case. And so I may think it's a fine idea in the abstraction, but I do not understand how these principles will work. What has taken place essentially in practice is, since the injury always takes place at the state of the plaintiff, that's a sufficient contact, and so it's local law that dominates. I can't conceive of a way to sort of organize more sophisticated responses that will deal with this. So if there's a problem here, this is not going to happen. I mean, we tried this. We were desperate to find it out, and nobody could come up with anything worth the powder to blow it to hell, quite literally. So I don't believe that that's true. I think the second point that Rick made in reverse is again, unfortunately correct, but it's because the entire state system of product liability law starts from Henningsen and the idea that all disclaimers of warranties and so forth are against public policy. You have the same attitude at the FDA. You have two non-libertarian institutions. It is not a helpful device to interpret what's going on that. What you really want to do with the state law, of course, if you're a libertarian like Rick, is to essentially reverse all the Henningsen-like decisions and to allow contract limitations on consequential damages to apply. And that's the really important reform if we're libertarians, rather than fussing around with all of these conflicts of interest laws, which weren't worth anything whatsoever. So I think on that particular point, you have to get a revolution. And one of the things that you discover politically is that the people who are most adamantly, quietly against this reversal are all defense lawyers who will be out of business if, in fact, you were to reverse the rules, so that don't count on having any natural allies in the bar for making sure that litigation is something which is not going to happen. With respect to Chevron deference, of course, we're again in complete agreement. The Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away. It is not a responsible fashion to allow these administrators to sort of make these kinds of silly statements one way or another. And I have as little respect for the Obama people doing it in the opposite direction as I do for the Bush people doing it in the one. The hardest question is the one that relates to the way in which we think about Wyeth and Levine and what goes on with respect to post-marketing review. And here I think that it's a much more complicated question than what Rick has sort of indicated. I've spent a lot of time trying to work through this stuff with respect to cancer drugs and so forth, and it turns out that the ineffectiveness of the FDA is dominated in a different fashion. All of the off-label uses are essentially regulated informally by voluntary organizations with worldwide scope, comprehensive indices, and so forth. So if you want to take a look at the NCCN, the National Cancer Comprehensive Database, and so forth, you will see a very different picture of how these things go, in which these adverse responses to various kinds of treatments, the hierarchies of first-line and second-line treatments and so forth, all take place. What's happened is that this informal Hayekian subculture essentially sets the standard of care in medical malpractice cases, and in addition to that, it sets the standards for reimbursement with respect to all insurance. The great difficulty you have with off-label uses is you must get one on-label use before you can have multiple off-label uses, and that means that the bottleneck effect at the first stage is absolutely critical on this, but we have no empirical evidence which suggests that the risks associated with off-label uses are higher than those which are associated with authorized uses, and there is some degree of suspicion which says that they're probably better because in many cases with the off-label uses, you've had very long track records, whereas you get a new drug which is authorized for the same condition, you have the problem that Rick referred to. You're running a base of 2,000 tests, and you have less confidence in that than you have in a drug for which the informal network has overseen it. The question is then, what do we do about the Wyeth and Levine case under these circumstances? And I think Rick is basically shooting the wrong horse in this particular case. The right response, I think, is that we look at it as this follows. We say, here you have a situation in which the doctor knew of all the various alternatives. I think it is wrong in these cases to start from the assumption when you had a drug on the market from 1955, which has been in constant use, that somehow or other there's nobody out there who is warned of the fact that the various kinds of push injections create hazards that are not available from other sources. And so what happens is the right way to think about this case is to assume that there's full information regardless of what the label says, because the downstream culture grows up precisely because the FDA is such a preposterous organization on these things. And you now ask the question of whether or not it's medical malpractice for doing it. You take every single word that Rick has done, and what you do is you have yourself an incredibly strong situation in which you say, for somebody with this kind of sensitivity and these particular needs, we don't want to do this. But what about more generally? Well, one of the things that happens with many people when we talk about liability, and I've seen this all the time, is that to talk about pain and to talk about nausea is always to talk about something which is a small deal rather than to talk about a big deal. And I think that what I try to remind people is that it isn't your nausea, it isn't your pain. And sometimes this stuff is really a very big deal, and that you really don't call it as being life-threatening, and you're right to some extent, but on the other hand, the dehydration that follows with somebody with diabetes and so forth is, you don't want to be so confident at the generic level that everybody who's doing this thing is wrong, and that you probably want to have the opposite result, which is that common practice on an issue which is this transparent and open, they may know something that Rick doesn't know and something that I don't know, and since I don't know everything, anything, I will be quiet and Rick will continue the discourse.
Well, I teach choice of law, and I realize that it might be a quixotic quest to try to make choice of law actually internalize states' decisions. But the only 2 points I want to make is, first of all, it's a quest worth embarking on again, even though it's been difficult. And the second question is, suppose we were to say, and I think I agree with Richard on this one, that the best way to regulate drug use in this case is to sue the doctor, and in this case, Ms. Levine sued the doctor and got settled for $700K. And let, you know, the contractual relationship between the doctor and the patient and ordinary malpractice law govern liability. Suppose we were to say that that really is the ideal rule. Would it be legitimate to federalize that rule without Congress's say-so? And the first point I want to say is that choice of law could work if properly reformed, if we have in our mind the pole star that should guide choice of law. And second of all, that although I agree with Richard that in the Levine case, the best rule is, in fact, the doctor should be liable, the manufacturer should not be the insurer for every dumb mistake the doctor makes. Nonetheless, I don't feel right in federalizing that rule. First of all, just on choice of law, very quickly. Suppose you said that manufacturers can specifically exit the market of any state by taking certain kinds of self-conscious measures, maybe registering with the feds, maybe simply not having ads in that state, such that liability decisions in that state would always be priced into the goods of that state only. That is to say, when Vermont imposes huge liability on Wyeth, Wyeth's products in other states don't go way up. And so Vermont internalizes the cost of its plaintiff's bar. If we could accomplish that goal of cost internalization to states, then I think we wouldn't have to worry about bad liability decisions. The states would correct it for themselves. This has largely worked with medical malpractice, because the choice of law rule for medical malpractice is cite us where the operation was performed, and so states actually internalize their dumb medical malpractice rules, which means there's a huge incentive in state legislatures to cap damages. Michigan did it, even though Michigan has a very powerful plaintiff's bar. Colorado did it. It happens all the time, because if you have a really generous liability rule in your state, you might find that your ER personnel or your OBGYN personnel can't get insurance. And that cost will only be imposed on the state that imposes the dumb rule. So that's the pole star. How we accomplish it, what sort of rules will operationalize internalization of cost, I don't know. But that's where our energy should be focused. Last point. Should we have a federal law preventing the manufacturer from being an insurer when insurance would be really dumb? I mean, suppose that, you know, you sue a doctor because he cut somebody stupidly with a scalpel. And you sue him because you said you should have put a warning on the scalpel saying scalpels are really sharp. Obviously, that's essentially saying the manufacturer should have strict liability to insure the errors of the doctor, and you might get too much insurance that way. There's a lot of literature on that, and it seems to me intuitive that you would. I agree. And it seems to me it would be a very good rule to change to make sure that we don't have too much insurance. But no one can argue that the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act embodies that principle. And so for having that principle sneak into our jurisprudence seems to me deeply illegitimate. Sneak into it under the guise of implied preemption. It seems to me wrong. Congress never made such a judgment. When the FDCA was enacted, no one dreamed of having such a rule. And so it seems to me, in the interest of democratic legitimacy, we should not be pushing that rule through litigation. If there's one thing that the Federalist Society believes in, it is the idea that principles which have not received the approval of the democratic process should not be enforced by judges inadvertently or under the radar screen of democratic scrutiny. And it seems to me that the principles of implied preemption that are being enforced today since maybe Buckman in 2000, 2001, I can't remember, these principles are really an underhanded way to get a correct libertarian rule, but in a democratically illegitimate manner. And for that reason, even though I agree with Richard on the merits, I think this needs to be worked out with the states. It can be worked out in the states with the right choice of law rule. And if we all just put our nose to the grindstone and think about how choice of law can be improved, I think we can solve the problem without empowering the federal Leviathan.
Is that you can't transship an operation, you can transship a drug. So what happens is you get very high prices for Vermont drugs and you buy them over the counter and ship them in from New Hampshire and so forth. I mean, the distribution systems are so complicated, the cost allocation systems are so complex, and the liabilities come so many years after the actual sales are made. This is a I think is a fool's errand, and you ought not to try that. I think what you really want to do is to understand that the tension is between the libertarian side of the federal society and the democratic side, because it's quite clear at the state level the block on contracts has created enormous distortions with both medical and product markets.
You want to respond?
No. That's good. Questions?
Well, this is really a scintillating crowd. If you don't have it, I'm going to take on some more points if you don't have
Surely.
I'm going to make another point then. And then just to provoke you people to this. I mean, the question about size of budgets and so forth. Look, I mean, the budgets are wildly undermanned. But one of the things is that they're also grotesquely misapplied. And so that what you say about the cosmetic stuff is, in fact, true. What you say about the question about the drugs that are going through new molecular entities for review, the cash shortage does not apply there in anything like it does in the other area. And, in fact, the response that the FDA has to the cash shortage is quite different from what Rick, I think, has indicated. It's not that they let something go through and they don't understand it. Quite the opposite. The dominant strategy has always been to say, look, we can spend $100,000 of administrative time to force you to do $100 million worth of tests. That makes us a really important agency. And so what you see that the true expenditures on the FDA are all off budget. I mean, when we organized a cancer conference at the AEI last year, I wrote this little paper called Against Permatitis, which is a fatal disease of the FDA. And it was at least one instance, and let me just give it to you. A friend of mine was developing a drug. You had to do worldwide testing to get enough people in it. It cost you $325 million to run this test, and some French office screwed up in a way which simply administered the drug in a way which probably increased the likelihood of adverse events. And the FDA's response to this thing was not to say, can we salvage the test by sophisticated analysis? God forbid. What they said, in effect, is, oh, no, no, there's clearly a demonstrable flaw in the test. You've got to put all the data aside and start over again, take another 5 years, another $300 million. What happens is an untested drug which has an on-label use, never tested for this condition, is similar enough that people decide to use it on an off-level basis. So what you've done, in effect, is you have one company spending $400 million or more on doing something so another company can take the advantage of an off-label use. And this is business as usual as the FDA. And when you ask Mr. von Eschenberg about what do you think about these sorts of things, what he does is he puts his arm around you and he says with a passion unmatched in human sympathy, everybody knows that everybody in this room is here solely to serve the benefit of the patient, and whereupon you want to never mind them. But, I mean, you've got to understand that this FDA story is much more complicated, and neglect is not the appropriate metaphor to use on the drug side, even if it is once they do it. And the other thing is, I don't know if any of you, I worked on a case called Nutraceutical, but when they decided to go after dietary supplements, they spent a lot of money on this with a set of scientific techniques that were so outrageous that if anybody had used it to get a drug on the market, they'd be in jail, and the FDA was allowed to use it to get it off the market under Chevron deference. So, I mean, you know, the whole agency, the budgetary stuff doesn't begin to capture the erratic nature of the activities that are undertaken by them. Now, somebody ask a question. Come on, and announce who you are, Mr. Kamek.
It seems to me, Rod, you by your third criterion, eliminate that criterion for an originalist purpose, and then promise through this refinement of choice of law doctrine to live up to an originalist principle. I'd like to hear a little bit more about how that last proposition will do it. Richard, you're just giving up on originalism because of libertarian value?
No, let him answer first.
Do I speak in this? I guess I do. So it seems to me that if you're going to enforce the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, you ought to enforce the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, which means that its original purpose, whether you take an intentionalist stance of a sort of subjective intentionalist stance, or the purpose of its language is inferred, you know, by text and structure. I want to sidestep that debate. It seems to me that should be the focus. If you take that focus, it seems to be impossible to get a libertarian outcome. Okay. Now, what about choice of law principles? Well, choice of law principles transcend any particular statute. They're largely common law principles, which the court devises. I think the court was crazy in Claxon to say that they should be state principles under Erie. That's nuts. It seems to me of all
principles that should be part of federal law, choice of law should be federalized. And I think that most choice of law scholars would agree to that, that Claxton was wrongly decided. So why can't we overrule Claxton? Well, the court can't because of stare decisis, but Congress could. Congress, in fact, could devote a lot more energy to choice of law than it ever has. Choice of law is one of the areas that Congress assiduously ignores, even though under Article 4, Section 1, it has plenary power over choice of law. It can decide what the legal effect of acts are. So why doesn't it? Well, one reason it doesn't is because I think choice of law has... I'm going to say something that might make people mad. Are there any choice of law scholars here? I think choice of law tends to be too doctrinal and not policy-oriented enough. I think the scholarship tends to be that way. I think we should have a big lobby. I think ATRA should have a big lobby for choice of law reform. And the idea should be, look, if Alabama or Madison County, Illinois, or Creek County, Oklahoma want to be nuts with tort law, that's fine. But let's quarantine them. And there are ways you can do it. Now, I think Richard's right. You know, you have mass distribution of drugs. It can't simply be, did a box of drugs end up in, you know, did a box of antihistamine end up in Vermont? It's got to be much more consciously contractual than that. And how you devise the system probably will require statutory reform. We've gotten some statutory reform of choice of law. I would say the Parental Kidnapping Act, you know, the Milk Box Act, to try to get parents from stopping sending their kids over state lines. We get very little choice of law reform with tort. I'd like to see more of it. And I don't think it would violate any kind of original understanding of a statute, because statutes don't typically come with their own choice of law principles attached. Those are trans-statutory common law principles that the federal court by rights ought to be enforcing. And certainly for statute, federal statutes, they could enforce, even regardless of Erie.
First of all, on the choice of law questions, back in the 1970s, I was hired by the American Insurance Association to work with them on product liability reform with the Interagency Task Force, which was this combination of, I guess it was Treasury, Commerce, and Labor, trying to figure out what to do. And we spent an enormous amount of time trying to figure out whether or not we could get these guys to buy on to a federal choice of law, tort law. And what we found out was as follows. We could not figure out one that any of us had any confidence in would last more than a week in terms of adjudication. And so the industry actually became in favor of uniform federal standards on what would otherwise be a tort stat to prevent the externalization and the race to the bottom as we perceived it. And then we ran into the institutionalists, led at that time by Irwin Griswold, who was saying tort has always been a state kind of function, and you don't want to mess around by federalizing something. And the state law judges went there. And so essentially the whole thing broke down. On the question of originalism, there is a painful truth that we all have to acknowledge, which is that originalism is a fine theory which tells you what to do before the train has gone off the tracks. So as a good originalist, you know, when I look at a kid's decision like Wickard and Filburn and so forth, I say to myself, my. Lochner, New York is also clearly wrong, not because there isn't a kind of liberty right there, but it's in the wrong clause. It's privileges and immunities that drove all of that stuff. It wasn't procedural due process. And we have to contend with the fact that Slaughterhouse made a big mess of that. I take it there's also widespread agreement on that, right? That nobody thinks that Slaughterhouse was rightly decided. So the question about originalism is, if I'm in my first best world, I think you've got very strong grounds to strike down virtually every state restriction to the extent that it limits freedom of contract and the provision of medical services and product liability, unless you can show a contractual flaw of serious proportions which justifies the restriction in question. And you can't get that if you just look at the restatements on torts. It's a criminally incompetent document. It says in Section 18, everybody knows that every contract for the sale or purchase of any product is infected by imperfect information and inequality of bargaining power, full stop, right? It's written with the same degree of elegance as the preemption statement, right, and comparable stupidity. I mean, you know, these guys wrote this stuff, and the fact that the entire bar is willing to sign on to it has shown just how far down the road to perdition we have traveled as a nation of torts and professional lawyers on that issue. I mean, that's, I think, so scandalous. But we now have the Commerce Clause stuff, which is out of whack. And we have the substantive due process privileges and immunity stuff, which is out of whack. So what happens is, if everything is out of whack and you can't go back to the first version because political forces are too strong, do you sort of treat this one issue as being an original oasis in a sea of modern sin? Or do you say, look, what's happened is every other system has started to change. Those things are invulnerable. Why is it that this one system can't move? And so my argument really about the rights preemption stuff is this is 1946 tort law against 1946 regulation. We now got 2008 tort law. It ain't the same beast. The regulation isn't the same regulation and so forth. What we have to do is to have, quote, unquote, if part of the Constitution's going to live badly, then the rest of it ought to live dangerously and well, becomes, I think, my provision. And what you have to say is, look, no, we're not going to set the preemptions in this particular fashion because the functional dangers are so great. Now, notice what Rick's defense is, and I think this is a very instructive thing. He did not argue that it was dysfunctional. What he argued is if you really understand what was going on in Wyeth and Levine, it was a perfectly respectable course of action, right? And we can fight over whether that's true or false, but that's a very different line than, for example, if you take the Regal case where the guy essentially overinflates the darn thing, right, where there's nothing else going on and it's a terrible malpractice case by everybody's standard and you want to get the federal remedy. So I think, in effect, maybe you just answer me, whether or not, what's your take on the on the angioplasty, where you stick the balloon angioplasty. You've got to give us your views on that case, whether you like it or not. So, I mean, I regard that as, again, I thought that Scalia wrote a pretty good opinion on that one, and that preemption was correct, and that the New York Times, surprisingly enough, was wrong. And I'm just curious as to what you think about that.
Well, you put me on the spot. But
yes,
I'm two aspects of Regal. First of all, you're dealing with the Medical Devices Act, which has an express preemption clause. And quite apart from that nicety, everybody knows that every iota of a catheter has been specified by the FDA in advance, and it cannot be varied by the manufacturer. So when Medtronic makes a catheter, it's not like they can change in response to tort law. It's very different than the labeling regime, where it's explicitly acknowledged that if you, after marketing a drug, discover some risk, you can improve the label. You know, you can add a warning. You could actually say, for instance, never use push injection in case of an emergency. And that's obviously the right thing to do in that case. So I just think they're different regimes, and I think with a Regal might be very well rightly decided because there's simply no room for the defendant, given what federal law specified, to change the design of its catheters. And so holding them liable in this case is sort of making them an insurer for the federal government's stupidity, if stupidity it was. Incidentally, I see nothing wrong with the catheter. I mean, if you look at the actual case, the doctor was an idiot. He should have overinflated the catheter. It said don't overinflate the catheter, right? You know. So, yeah, I tend to think that Regal was rightly decided, and Scalia really heavily rests on express preemption. And he was right to rest on express preemption.
What about good?
And you can't do that in the, well, oh, this is a cigarette case. You don't want to hear about Altria v. Good. So.
Yes, we do.
They might have a question out there.
Somebody ask about Altria v. Good. I'm waiting.
Any questions? Oh, I have one.
Okay.
I'd like to give Rick a chance to answer what seems to me a problem with the choice of law argument, which is, I think, demonstrated by Richard's story, that actually it was very hard to write something. I think he said that he couldn't be sure that judges wouldn't mess up, and particularly given that conflicts of law is not exactly transparent to the public. It's kind of like a standing doctrine. Mm-hmm. Judges are notoriously result-oriented, and, of course, the same reason we have some very bad state common law is that judge is also rather non-transparent, maybe a little more transparent than conflicts of law. They've messed up in a variety of ways. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't we expect exactly the same thing to happen?
Yeah. You know, and I have some nerve coming in here saying we should reform choice of law when I don't have a choice of law principle I could pull out of my pocket. I want you guys
to. Well, you're an honest guy.
But here's the basic idea. First of all, I think it would have to be by statute. Second of all, I think it would have to have an administrative regime of registration where a manufacturer can say, I am not doing business in Vermont on some federal registry. I'm not doing business in Vermont. If my goods are sold in Vermont, they're missold. If they're administered in Vermont, they're misadministered. They cannot be used in Vermont. So manufacturers can decide to pull out of markets. They won't do it in the sense that their goods will never go into Vermont. They might go to Vermont quite regularly. But it seems to me that a federal statute that gave the manufacturer the capacity to withdraw from jurisdictions, as it were, as a legal fiction, would solve the problem. Because, in effect, any jurisdiction that imposed excessive insurance costs on a manufacturer would lose a drug. Now, why would that? How could a judge misconstrue that? First of all, we could take it away from the judge. We could eliminate judicial review and have it be administered by a federal agency if you want it to be administered by a federal agency. Second of all, you could have really bright line rules. I think the problem is choice of law has been enforced according to state law, 50 states, doctrinally rather than statutorily. And that's, of course, a recipe for disaster, right? Because any state that tried to act alone in reforming choice of law will find that plaintiffs would drag the case to a rival state that's more plaintiff-friendly. And so it's precisely that collective action problem among the states that make Claxon moronic, right? I mean, imagine saying this is one area the states obviously can't handle, interstate disputes about law. And so what you have, of course, is a pro-plaintiff choice of law and personal jurisdiction regime, simply because any state that said, we are going to have a doctrine that favors defendants won't find very many cases, right? And so you need a federal statute. It needs to be administered according to bright-line rules, and it should be written by you guys, not me.
One of the things that Mike McConnell proposed when he wrote about this, I guess, about 20, 25 years ago, which is not a conflicts rule as such, but he says, in effect, you would get a federal statute which would announce that the manufacturer of a particular drug understands that all of its products would be judged only by the rule of the home state or its principal place of business. And then you protect that. And unless that principal place, you know, it has to be one of the 50 states in the United States and so forth, you do that. I mean, it's going to have generations of it, because what's going to go on there is the electoral politics and deciding that chain state, deciding whether or not 3 years later you can move your headquarters in order to change the choice of law stuff is going to be there. But that's another possibility. None of us wanted to use these proposals back in the mid to late 70s. I mean, we thought that we were just playing with fire. So we did not want to do it. But I still haven't heard your views on Altria v. Good.
Well, there might be another question out there.
There is.
Unfortunately, not an Altria v. Good.
Give your name.
Yeah, Byron Steyer, Southwestern Law School. So I was wondering if there's some way to sort of split the difference, you know, have us all come together here at the end of our debate and find a middle ground on it. And I'm wondering if it has to be so one way or the other on preemption. Particularly, I read Professor Epstein's recent short Forbes piece in which you discussed this and start out by saying something like admit, no, insist that the FDA is wrong or imperfect. But then you went on to say that but generally the errors are all in one way, being too cautious.
Yeah.
And so I'm concerned upon reading that if we're admitting and insisting that there are errors, the kind of skepticism that Professor Hills is talking about, that we shouldn't be allowing those decisions then to be dispositive of state tort lawsuits. And I'm wondering if there isn't an alternative that allows the decision of the FDA to come in the state trial in any number of ways. Professor Epstein, in your casebook, which I enjoy using, custom, you know, having it come in as a customary approach to due care, coming in as some kind of expert testimony. The FDA has held this. You know, courts have the ability to appoint boards of experts under the evidentiary rules. Is there some way to allow a middle ground in which the FDA's decision comes in as one mechanism to define due care but doesn't dispose of the whole lawsuit, given that we would probably all admit the FDA makes mistakes from time to time?
Both ways. Let me again start to talk about my clients from 30 years ago. I mean, and they're not my clients since then. Is that this was the basic position that all of them took, which is that the important line in these cases was not the line between liability and no liability. The important line was the line between summary judgment and no summary judgment. Their attitude was that the moment you get to a trial, you could let anything in and you could play anything for what it is worth. So that, for example, in the Vioxx cases, which are, I dare say, a lot more complicated than this capsule summary that you heard, this is what the plaintiffs did the first time, is they took every volume of evidence that was done there, and you say, look, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, Merck is sufficiently evil that it will submit 26 volumes worth of stuff that conceals the essential truth that this product is dangerous for human life. And then you'll make them disappear from the table and say, it's up for you to say whether big companies that pad the records should be held responsible when responsible individuals like you can find out the nefarious actions that go on. That's what happens. Let me give you another illustration of the same point, again from the 70s, because there was a fellow, I love this story, named Charlie Babcock, who was the sort of public relations guy, former military guy for GM when it was a company, on car design. And he said he built the Babcock mobile. which is what you did is you took the liability rules, which are basically what you said. You could introduce the statute as evidence of reasonableness now. And what he did is he made every modification that was required by some jury verdict which found the car to be inadequate on the strength of an alternative design proposed by plaintiffs, right? And he put them all on the same car. And now the question is, what happened to the Babcock mobile? He said, this is what the report was. Well, it sprouted 1,000 additional pounds. It added about $5,000 additional dollars at that time. And he said it had the modest inconvenience that it would not move when put into drive. And so you see that the serious problem about this is ex post reconstruction on a partial basis is always subject and fraught to immense kinds of difficulties. And I dare say if you're trying to sort of talk to doctors about clinical judgment, their attitude is, after the fact, even the fool is wise. And it's the hindsight stuff that gets you, which is why you got to have a more categorical kind of protective rule if you're going to play this. And what's so hard about this situation is that the defendants are right. They sweep the table, right? There's no duty to warn cases in the United States. Everything turns on a combination of industry information that's widely disseminated and known, or FDA standardized warnings, or consumer groups and so forth. Or you have the current situation. And that's why it's such a hard choice, because reasonable people like you just simply can't get a seat at the table.
Yeah, just on that, very briefly, I want to just make a plug for Kathy Sharkey, my colleague at NYU, and her agency reference model. Here's how I think implied preemption cases should be handled according to the Sharkey method, which is essentially if the FDA has made a considered judgment about a specific risk, that governs and it preempts. It's just that simple. If they haven't, it doesn't. And it seems to me that that would solve 90% of your problems. Now, on the FDA intervening, quite often the FDA files amicus briefs, but almost always in federal court, very rarely in state court. Kathy's done a survey, and it isn't, you know, intuitively plausible given that the amount of tort litigation in state court dwarfs that in federal court. It seems to me that if the FDA intervenes with something like a preemption preamble that simply says, we think our standards are preemptive, even if there's no real standard on point, that should carry no weight whatsoever. If the FDA were to go into court, though, and say, we have evidence that it is useful to preserve push injection for antihistamines, and they do have evidence, they win. It turns out that the FDA is extraordinarily cautious on the upfront ex ante line of review, what we call clinical trials, and extraordinarily lax on the ex post review of post-market risk surveillance. And that shouldn't surprise you, because that's the way Congress operates as well. And that's the way Congress allocates the FDA's budget. After the FDA's post-market surveillance of adverse events became the headline news across the country because of the Vioxx business, Congress allocated, drumroll please, $25 million to the FDA. That is a joke. But the reason why is there's really no mileage in giving the FDA a lot of budget to constantly monitor drugs after they've been approved. People like the approval of drugs. There's a big lobby to get drugs approved. And there's a consumer advocacy group that wants to sue companies for drugs that shouldn't be approved. But there's very little interest in seeing how things work after they're put on the market.
And by the way, on the Vioxx stuff, there is still a very serious debate. And there are many people who think that the ban was a mistake.
No. I'm not arguing about that was central headline stuff.
We understand that. Let me just mention to you some of the problems. That is, the major use of Vioxx in hospital is very different from the major use of Vioxx outside of hospital on a long-term basis. And there is still no drug on the market which is good for controlling intestinal bleeding following surgery, as Vioxx was before it was taken off. And the heart attack risk on the basis of a week of use and so forth is negligible. All of the studies which purported increased stuff take place after the 18-month period when, in general, you would not recommend its use anyhow. And the problem with that particular data is that, for one thing, the number of people who use it that long is sufficiently small that the statistical confidences aren't there.
No objection. I mean, my sister was working for Williams & Connolly for years as a Vioxx defense lawyer, and so I was regaled with these stories every evening. I agree 100%. I'm merely bringing it up because I'm going to say this is
is a case where Congress is really focused
on getting it right. No, but you haven't got the punchline. The punchline on this is that every bit of this stuff is going to come out in the Sharkey review proposal as to whether or not, when you say we've made a considered return, whether it's been considered enough of all the things that are involved in these cases. So Kathy and I have this huge ongoing battle in which I want a litmus test and she wants a trial to see whether or not you have a trial and which other things are going to be admissible. And my view, having spent many years in litigation, is that the single force that you fear most is legal friction, and that this proposal just generates more friction than it does light, and so that therefore you want to have something which is more categorical. And the Vioxx case, I mean, the other thing you should know, I don't know if you've ever read what the New England Journal of Medicine did in order to discredit the Merck studies by making essentially false charges of scientific misconduct based upon its own desire from its own public relations expert that they not be caught with their pants down on the way in which they published the Racine study or the Bombauer study. It's also very interesting reading as to what is going on. I mean, the whole field through litigation can only be described as a swamp, and the good guys are not always the good guys. It's both ways. I mean, and if you just want to remember that Texas verdict, the whatchamacallit, Ernst v. Merck, it was reversed on appeal. I mean, they didn't get it. I mean, a lot of publicity. It's a crazy system for litigation, I have to say. Now, I don't know if there's any more questions, but I still want to hear his blue or ungood. Eugene.
I'll make it a two-part question in deference to Richard. One part is to pick up on the Wythe case. On the Wythe case. I was interested in
on the Wythe case.
Yes. Yeah. Oh. Rick Hill's point. I was interested in your response to what I thought was an interesting point of Richard's and a classic example of the problems in this area. You know, yeah, you're nauseous. You know, even if it's not life-threatening, if you're talking about, I think you were talking about 1 in 150,000 or something like that. You know, that may be, at some level, dealing with nausea may be worth the risk, even if there's no life-threatening thing. And how that choice is made is not necessarily one that should be purely regulatory. And the second part of my question is to ask Richard about, I'll say very good.
About what?
I'm asking you your question. I'm forgetting the name of the case.
Oh, good?
Yes.
Good.
Yeah. That's the second part of my question.
Oh, well, you start. Yep.
Look, if the FDA wants to come in and say what it never, ever, ever said, which is that it would be a good idea in emergencies when somebody says, Doctor, I'm going to puke. Oh, God, give it to me, to use push injection. If the FDA wants to say that, I'm prepared to give it deference. And I'm prepared to let that preempt state tort lawsuits. What's really interesting about Wyeth is, A, Wyeth is going to win this case. And, B, the FDA never said anything like that.
Why is Wyeth going to win?
I'm just taking bets.
At the Supreme Court level.
Yeah, they're going to win at the Supreme Court level.
Yeah, I think it's not because of Wyeth. I think it's because of all the cases they think will follow if Wyeth, in fact, goes out the other way.
So my point is, of course, it might very well be the case that even though there's a significant chance the arm will fall off for an antihistamine, you ought to use push injection and not take the time to put a bag up there on the little stand. And if the FDA is willing to put its money where its mouth is and say that and have some evidence to back it up according to the 706 arbitrary and capricious standard, I'll go with that. They didn't. And what's bizarre is to have an implied preemption doctrine where they don't have to. Now, on Altria v. Good, oh, my God, it's a cigarette case. This is a Stevens opinion that follows up on Cipollone or Cipollone. I never know how to say it. How do you say it?
Cipollone. My client was Philip Morris.
So, okay, you know, and I mean, I don't want to go into the nitty-gritty details, but this is a case in which there's a claim of fraud because the cigarette company, Altria, is marketing a cigarette as low tar. And the question is that baloney, given that if you call something low tar, people smoke more of them, so you get more tar? I mean, this is like those low-cal desserts where all they do is they take the cake and cut up into smaller servings, right? You know, and so you say, oh, it's low-cal. I'll eat the whole darn box. Okay, so can you sue these people for fraudulently saying that this thing is low-tar when they know darn well that you're going to compensate, you know, by smoking more cigarettes? And, you know, they know darn well because maybe they find a smoking gun, no pun intended, you know, in the files during discovery. And the big question is whether this fraud claim is preempted by a federal statute that says no health requirements can be imposed by the states. And Stevens writes an opinion saying, well, this isn't a health requirement because it's just about fraud. It's got nothing to do with health. In fact, you don't have to prove any effect on health. You simply have to prove that they said it was low tar and it's not. Now, given that damages are entirely set by the health effects, one can say that this is at least a muddled opinion. And I think Stevens' reasoning in the opinion is disastrous. I do think the central point of Altria, although it's hard to ferret out of there, is correct, which is preemption should always be purpose-based, never effects-based. By that I mean that you should look to the judgment that the state made, the intentional actual judgment that they made, and see if that contradicts the federal judgment. You should have looked to whether state law will have a general effect of causing regulated entities to do something that the feds want to discourage. Basically, the central insight of Altria, although Stevens really wrapped it around a tree in terms of specific analysis, is that it's a purpose-based test. So if the state genuinely says, look, we're not interested in health, we're interested in making sure you don't tell lies to customers, then it doesn't really matter that in the course of preventing lies to customers, you cause cigarettes to change their labeling on health, like getting into the low-tar label. That seems to me correct. Now, there is a question about whether the state judge, you know, in issuing this common law ruling on fraud, really is only interested in lies rather than health effects. And so it might be that Altria's reasoning was right, but the result was wrong. And you could say, look, you can call it fraud, but we really know what you're trying to do. You're trying to regulate the health warning on a cigarette. And you can't do that because the Fed said our health warning is exclusive. Okay. So that's my pitch on Altria.
Let me give my pitch on Altria. At least just say a couple things about it. First of all, the thing to understand is this was not an action for which people were claiming actual health care damages. That is, there was no argument that there was any harm to the people suffered by virtue of the warning. So to that extent, it is not like the standard cancer cases, and it becomes to some extent the consumer protection case, which is what he was talking about. What Stevens seems to have conceded in the opinion is that if you had a state statute which was having to deal with truth in warnings with respect to cigarette and only cigarette labels, even if you were bringing this identical cause of action, it would in fact be preempted by the statute. But he says that since you made it a general statute which applies to grapefruit juice, which is mislabeled with respect to caloric content, it doesn't matter. I think the right answer should be we don't care whether the state statute is general or specific. If it applies to health and, in fact, there is a smoking and it's based on health and claims, it's going to be preempted so that the key point of that thing is not purpose versus effect. It's general versus specific statute. The second point one wants to make is this is not a small deal what's going on. The claims in these cases then get played out as follows, and this I think has to be regarded as crazy. These are misrepresentation cases. The logic would be that you have to give them damages equal to the amount of money they spent above and beyond they would have spent if they had given the true state of affairs as the state court treats it. And that turns out to be a very kind of mystical number because it's going to be small. Because clearly the cigarettes have some benefits to these people in terms of subjective taste and satisfaction. The plaintiffs immediately come in and say, well, we can't have a class action if we're going to have to prove individual representation, so we have a better idea. And the better idea is that you just refund all the money even though we can't refund any of the cigarettes, so that the damage claim is one which says you have to refund every dollar you receive with respect to these cigarettes, light cigarettes were sold, so that when they had it as an Illinois-based class action only, it was a $10 billion affair. So to kind of sort of treat this case, you run into all the absurdities of the Consumer Protection Acts under state law, compounded by this. And so I think the right answer in this particular case is, look, what they were worried about was non-uniform impositions of liability with respect to the marketing of tobacco. That preamble provision was not quoted by Justice Stevens, as I recall, in his provision. You read that against the rest of it, and the case turns out to be, well, wrong. And anyhow, I have to go to the airport.
Well, thank you very much. I think we...